ExchangeWire's ATS Singapore conference returns on July the 2nd, featuring the latest insights from an exceptional group of speakers highlighting future challenges and breakthroughs in media, marketing, and commerce. Visit exchangewire.com/events to get your ticket now. And for an exclusive 10% discount, use the code PODCAST10 at the checkout.
Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm Amy, editor at ExchangeWire and your host for today's episode. I'm here with our research lead, Matt. Hi, Matt, how are you?
Hey, Amy. I'm really good. Great to be here. And yeah, looking forward to today's discussion.
Yeah, great to have you with us as always. And our guest today, Christoph Jammet, who is Managing Director at Gather. Thanks for joining us, Christoph. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you. And so today we'll be discussing the latest news surrounding Meta with its plans to fully automate ad creation, another deal bridging the worlds of AI and publishing, and YouTube's impressive TV viewership figures. So our first story is from the Wall Street Journal. Meta's announced that by the end of next year, it plans to give advertisers the ability to fully automate the entire ad creation process with AI. The company's ad platform already offers some AI tools that can generate variations of existing ads and make minor changes to them before targeting the ads to users on Facebook and Instagram. But this would take things to the next level. It would give advertisers the ability to create advertising concepts from scratch. Christoph, what are the potential negative consequences that could come about from this? What do you think?
You know, I think it's a pretty natural progression, and it's certainly alluring, especially to investors, I think. But I think the reality of it is that AI and automation in this context is going to be especially helpful on the targeting side of the house, more so than creative. I think that a couple things are going to happen into the future. One, you kind of have to pick between ubiquity and being unique or differentiation. So if AI becomes ubiquitous in terms of imagery across the ad stack, it becomes the new baseline, right? It becomes kind of the new clickbait standard because I think you see a lot of low effort AI-generated content that starts to flood the market, which we've already seen before, and I think it's been affectionately coined as a AI slop. And so I think humans, users, are probably going to start to notice that, and probably have the same kind of reactions, psychological reactions to clickbait over the last few years. I think you're going to kind of see some parallels there. So that's kind of what I'm focused on. I think it's great for a targeting and identification improvements, but in terms of like end-to-end creative creation, there's a lot of brand risk, you know, because you can't just, it takes more than just shoving a bunch of brand standards and style guides into a rag and telling it to just do whatever it wants, right? Derivatives still require human intervention to make sure they're being brand safe. And it's really a lot harder to manage that with visuals over written content. So I think that's kind of where I'm at. Also, I think there's a generational split, especially when you're talking about Meta properties. You know, it's kind of a meme at this point, but I think boomers are going to be a lot more susceptible or maybe even amenable to AI generated ad content versus millennials and younger, where there is a much higher premium on like proof of life activities, authentic interactions between people. I think people are starting to be conditioned to trust AI generated brand voice much less than when they know an individual is representing a brand. So I think that's something to look out for as well.
Yeah, those are some good points. Matt, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree there. I think that creative piece is where these AI tools could fall down, especially with it being focused on that end-to-end creation. Like, if you look at you know, just my Facebook feed now, or anyone's Facebook feed, you know, in the top 10 posts on my feed when I look through, three were just direct rips off Reddit. One was a crappy edit of some Simpsons cartoon. One was a post discussing a film screening from 2 weeks ago. And one was a very in-depth discussion about ear eczema, which I've never suffered from nor even heard of. And if that's the, you know, the quality of posts on the main feed, why would you trust that company to then, you know, use that feed technology to manage your ads from that end to end? You know, it's your creative, your brand, your messaging. Why would you outsource that to someone else? I've got some, you know, very good friends who work in creative industries, and the sheer amount of work they do to understand a brand, what drives that brand and how the messaging should reflect that, and what the marketers for that brand wants going forward is just absolutely phenomenal. And I think all Meta's AI tools will do is just amalgamate some basic prompts, align that with previous, you know, creative that the company has run. And that's, to me, that's not creative. That will not drive a response. That's just window dressing. A couple of weeks ago, I quoted Sinan Goodman and Erin Morris from Young Folks. And I'm going to do so again because it's just such a fantastic quote, which applies really well here. And that's that the best ideas, the ones that build brands, start conversations, win hearts, or piss the right people off, aren't born from pattern matching. They're born from risk. And if you think a $1 trillion company chasing quarterly earnings is going to take that creative risk on your behalf, good luck to you.
Yeah, I love that quote. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We're going to see much more generic ads, I think, when AI comes into it more. Because like you said, Matt, they don't have, you know, that depth of knowledge that the human teams can actually get.
Exactly.
And yeah, we'll start to notice a lot more AI slop, like you said, Christoph, I think. And so already, Christoph, you touched kind of on the positives for advertisers. How significant do you think these are versus the negatives?
You know, I think there's always room for improvement as it relates to targeting. I think that starts with good metadata. To that end, I think just to compare platforms, LinkedIn has been such a strong platform in comparison because the quality of the metadata they have on individuals is usually very truthful and correct and updated just by virtue of the platform itself. And, you know, AI doesn't solve a data quality problem, right? It's garbage in, garbage out, regardless of the AI layer you have on top. So as long as they're able to use good metadata, you're gonna find arbitrage opportunities on the ad stack for, you know, behavioral patterns that weren't noticed before because they were so subtle or because the existing analytics stack couldn't point it out. There might be some good audience expansion logic that comes through from this. You know, I think it's going to be a lot more dynamic, and I think that from that perspective, personalization is going to be great. But I think where personalization is going to start to run amok is when they start taking your photos and, you know, putting your face on you on a beach drinking a beer, and you being like, oh, that's, you know what I mean? I think pointing it towards stuff that creates uncanny valley discomfort is not where I would be focusing on. But there are certainly improvements to be gained on using AI's broad capabilities to better target, retarget, and meet people where they are behaviorally based on the data they have.
Yeah, definitely. And Matt, what would you say this move towards full automation means for the ad industry?
I think if we were to move towards that full automation piece, it brings up that concern that once again, as an industry, we're sliding towards that pipe dream of everyone can be specifically targeted with a specific ad, which I think is A, really ineffective, and B, just not feasible. And why would you do that? And, you know, to get all existential, should the ad industry or any industry be fully automated and fully optimized? You know, optimization is incredibly important, but should that necessarily be the end goal? Like, you know, look at examples, obviously Coca-Cola in the past, it tried to optimize its recipe with New Coke, and they got absolutely patented for that. And, you know, when I think of food, which I often do because I'm an absolute hog, do I think of some over-optimized nouveau cuisine dish, or do I think of some delicious Italian pasta? Presentation may not necessarily be there, but by God, it's delicious. And I think that's possibly what, you know, analogy we need to look at in terms of the ad industry. Optimize where needed. There are so many places in advertising which do need that optimization, particularly in, you know, looking, combating ad fraud, MFAs, etc. But there's a lot of things which shouldn't. You need to drive that response, that human response in people with your messaging. And yeah, don't necessarily look to AI to do that for you.
And Matt, I think the what's interesting about that is, you know, the secret ingredient to good advertising is it's led with empathy, right? It's it incorporates an innate understanding of what people like, don't like, what they're drawn to, what they're not drawn to. And I don't think that the current stack of AI tooling does a good job of that beyond the, you know, rat in a maze, chemical dopamine behavioral hit mechanisms that you can get. So I think, I do think though that, again, if it's going to become the baseline, right? Because Meta is going to be, and all these platforms are going to be incentivized to push it as something that could be done cheaply at scale. But that's going to make human-centered designed assets across the creative stack stand out all the more. It's going to create a premium on when humans create innately human output.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, those are some good points again. Now moving us on to our next piece of news, which is from the New York Times announcing its own content licensing deal with Amazon. The New York Times company has agreed to license its editorial content to Amazon for use in its AI platforms. This is its first licensing arrangement with a focus on generative AI. Christoph, the New York Times sued OpenAI in 2023 for copyright infringement. Do you think this move to partner with Amazon for content licensing is surprising now?
I don't think it's surprising. I think it's certainly, you know, I'm sure they'd rather find a viable path to figuring out how to leverage this content that, you know, the basis of good AI generated content is born from. I think it makes sense. I think you'll see a lot of larger organizations follow suit. But I do worry about it in a more globalized sense for what happens to smaller organizations, individual creators, you know, the innate value of content that's being created. It actually makes me think about the past history of photography licensing. You know, back in the mid-90s, photographers could earn something like, I don't know, $10 per image on platforms like iStock. And now, you know, it's percentage of pennies per image when you look at licensing and how it works now. That kind of makes sense because it's been democratized and scaled out. But I'm very curious to see where laws, society at large, and courts land on this, because, you know, the quality of AI is dependent on the best work that humans have created across history. And there's a large swath of professions and industries of people who make a living doing that. And so how do you make the most out of this very capable stack that has the potential to do so much while also not completely disenfranchising the people that made it possible?
Yeah, it's a very complicated situation. Matt, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think I wouldn't necessarily say the move is surprising, but it is incredibly interesting given, you know, its previous legal responses to AI scraping. And I think that brings up a lot of questions as to why they've partnered with Amazon. Is it because it sees more value in Amazon's AI than rival platforms? You know, the article announcing move discusses the closer linkage to Alexa and possible commerce opportunities. Or is it simply because Amazon has offered the New York Times an absolute wadge of cash? Amazon is, of course, playing catch up in the AI race, so no doubt they wanted that big scalp to shout about. So yeah, I'm sure they did offer a rather cushy package. Or is it even, you know, to go full tinfoil hat, is it a tactical move to undermine Microsoft and OpenAI in its legal battle against those? In a way, it's saying, look, we're perfectly happy to partner with AI firms, but we, you know, so we don't partner with those that, you know, those we don't partner with should not be scraping us. So yeah, there's a fair few potential reasons, but I completely agree in the sense that, you know, the smaller publishers, which don't necessarily have the the clout to that Amazon can come with these big financial packages, what happens to those guys?
I also wonder, Matt, I'm curious about your thoughts too, like the economic model for AI. It seems like the way it's currently being monetized and priced would not support people being what creators would consider properly compensated for their work being included in there. And so does that lead us down a path of like, enshittification down the line, like when free websites were just operating on this model that was long-term unsustainable? I'm very curious to see kind of where it nets out and how the industry adjusts its business models to keep it viable.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think at the moment, in terms of how copyright laws are laid out, we are heading towards that inshittification route. But I think an analogy which could be used by, those regulating AI, I think, is to look potentially at the music industry. Obviously, we had the pirate sites before Spotify came on, and that has both democratized music streaming, but also is more fully regulated. Yes, obviously there are discussions in terms of how creators are remunerated, but generally you are having millions upon millions of people legally streaming music, whereas previously it was pirated and those creators weren't being remunerated at all. So I think that's an analogy which could be relevant here. But I think in terms of how the regulation and how at the moment it's so piecemeal in terms of either regulation, legal action, or deals like this, it's just all a bit hit and miss and no one really knows what to make of it. I'm sure it will become clearer going forward, but I think especially on that regulation side of things do need to be a bit more concrete and a bit more consistent globally to allow that to happen.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. So as we just touched on that, but as large publications continue to partner with the AI giants, is there anything smaller publishers can do to receive fair compensation for their work, which is using AI at the moment?
I mean, I think you'll see some sort of consolidation or, circling of the proverbial wagons with smaller publishers or through AI licensing partners to try and find like a critical mass in order to bargain collectively. I mean, that's really what it comes down to is, is there going to be some unification on the creative side, like the way SAG-AFTRA has gone about it? I think this is a really good example of where that kind of collective bargaining can really, even the playing field. Cause otherwise it's just large corporation against small company or individual creator.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you can't expect those smaller creators, they don't have the resources to be actively monitoring or testing AI platforms and monitoring, either declared AI scrapers or undeclared spiders. They're working on their day to day. They shouldn't have to focus on that. So I think, either those collective bargaining agreements or I think, again, coming back to that point of regulation, once that becomes a bit more clear, I'm sure there'll be lots of lawyers champing at the bit to launch a class action lawsuit with regards to copyright laws if they found they're in violation of those. I think it will become better for those small publishers, but it's a bit unclear at the moment.
Yeah, it sounds like the collective bargaining is definitely the way to go at the moment. But it'll be interesting to see how the space develops and what ends up coming from there, because, there's definitely need for more regulation, I think. So we'll see what happens. Now, moving on to our third story and last one for today, let's look at YouTube. So according to Nielsen's April 2025 Media Distributor Gauge report, YouTube maintained its lead among media companies, representing 12.4% of audiences' time spent watching TV, marking YouTube's third consecutive month in first place, as well as being its largest share of TV to date. Christoph, is YouTube's dominance in streaming compared to most of its competitors at all surprising, do you think?
I think it's surprising in that, I've always, maybe the longer term perception I had of YouTube was that it was a bit of an underdog. But when you lay it all down, lay the facts bare, it's not surprising. They're sitting at this incredible convergence point that few other platforms can match, because they're plugged into search engines innately just by being part of Google. And even though, you know, there's also a whole other narrative of SEO is kind of taking a backseat to AI search, but it's also benefiting anyone that's posting on YouTube is gaining the benefit from the shift to AI search as well, because all of Google's models are being trained on what's on their platforms, including YouTube. You know, they also have this interesting mix of streaming content that is parallel to Netflix and Hulu and Disney Plus, et cetera, but they also are a burgeoning creator video economy, right? Because the combination of longer form landscape video plus portrait style shorts really allows them to sit in the biggest Venn diagram of all the other competitors. I see a lot of potential cross-platform benefit that creators and brands can leverage. A good example is podcasting, for example. And we've seen this with some of our clients where if you're producing a podcast and you start by producing it video first and you push it out on YouTube and then you push it out on audio-only platforms, you're just gaining a not just an extra audience, but an extra audience that has dialed in viewer behaviors that are different from audio only, because they're watching. They're not just listening. They're not getting distracted as much in the same way as listening to a podcast could. So I just see an incredible amount of cross-platform benefit that comes from YouTube being what it is. Yeah, it's been pretty incredible to see, actually.
Yeah, they're in a very unique position. Matt, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with Christoph there. And I think it's become an incredibly important part of the overall TV landscape. And to touch on that user-generated content piece, it's the only platform that really has that longer form UGC alongside that premium produced content. And obviously, you've got the short form video content platforms now, but in terms of that longer form, no one else is really there. And I think that UGC piece kind of comes under the radar a bit when it comes to how much YouTube has grown in TV. And I think in terms of the volume of content available, that's part of the piece. Like, you know, how often does Netflix drop a TV show that you're really interested in? Once a month, maybe twice a quarter. You know, I looked at YouTube today and in the past 3 days, 19 videos have been released by creators I'm subscribed to. No other platform can rival that in volume alone. But also I think we should look at the flip side in terms of how dominant YouTube really is, because it's also free at the point of use. And obviously in terms of these, you know, the comparisons that we're talking about here with Nielsen, all the others there, they're either, you know, premium tiers or, you know, ad supported. There's still a small cost with that. And therefore, if you're thinking about it, this platform has this massive amount of UGC content. It's free at the point of use. Should the conversation instead be a little bit more, how is it only outpacing a premium service like Disney by less than 2%? And I think it's just a, you know, interesting way to flip that. But either way, it's still an incredibly important part of the TV landscape for sure.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to spin it, Matt. What are your thoughts, Christoph?
I think it's interesting because you've also got the you know, ad-supported free layer versus the ad-free layer. Obviously, people get differing levels of benefit if they're a Google One subscriber, et cetera, stuff like that. You also have innate platform advantage with the Android community. So I think that's a consideration as well. I would also maybe dare to mention that YouTube doesn't necessarily need to be the best in every one of these categories, because once you're on there, are YouTube Shorts quality-wise better than what I get served up on TikTok? Maybe not. And the dynamic is certainly less social. But just the way it's plugged in and integrated to everything you do, even down to an operating system layer for mobile, is really interesting. And then Disney, on the other hand, is really leaning on the ecosystem of content it has, right? Once they circled the wagons between Disney and Marvel, et cetera, and started you know, partnering with Hulu on live television, you've got like a different value prop, and you also have a baked in family audience consideration that Disney has, because it's certainly a little more safe for that demographic to just rip through Disney. But really, really interesting. It's a good point. Definitely worth thinking about.
Yeah. And Matt, do you think there are any specific challenges for advertisers when it comes to advertising alongside video content on YouTube?
Yeah, I think there's a couple. I think they have improved in recent years. Obviously, YouTube was probably more highly exposed to ad blocking than many other platforms. And I think Google just needs to continually work with both advertisers and creators to make sure that, you know, that ad podding and ad duration doesn't necessarily become too overly burdensome for the user to the point they feel they have to use, you know, ad blockers. I think obviously you've had those legacy brand safety / content adjacency concerns. And that does seem to have improved, or everyone seems to care about it a little less, depending on where you sit on that side of things. I think the main thing that advertisers should also consider, and especially we've seen it discussed a lot more in the industry over the last few months, is that attention quality side of things. And yes, YouTube is undoubtedly on the screen for a phenomenal amount of time, but coming back to my UGC point earlier in the way that it could be, you know, both a blessing and a curse, how much of that viewing is background viewing? How much of that is they're on the second screen on their phone? Google published a stat way back in 2021 that 2 in 3 users are watching YouTube on a second screen when watching TV at home. Now that they're obviously focusing a lot more on having YouTube on that main screen, they've hidden that stat on their website. I only get through that from Wayback Machine. So yeah, I think that attention quality piece, I'm sure advertisers have access to a lot more detailed numbers in terms of how the users are engaging with their ads on YouTube. But yeah, just in terms of the general conversation, it's an interesting one, I think, to consider.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. The quality of attention is so important, obviously. Christoph, what do you think there about any specific challenges for advertisers advertising on YouTube? Is there anything you can add?
It's certainly an interesting point, because depending on the content you're consuming on YouTube, it's sometimes like more not primary focus friendly. Like you're listening to a lo-fi mix that has a weird little animation that's overlaid on it, or you know, YouTube occupies this really interesting space where it's also a music consumption platform, even if there's video, and you still get to benefit from it as an audio-only platform, even if you're not paying attention to what's being watched. And I think that's the benefit of it, is there's like it gets the benefit of being inclusive but not prescriptive about whether you're watching or listening with certain formats of content that are on there. But yeah, I think they're always going to have to balance the ratio of ad insertion. And I think that's also relative to competitors and to what competitors offer as tiers. Because, the reality is that if subscribers didn't have to sit through ads, they wouldn't. So I think that creates an interesting constraint, but also might create creativity as well, or might invite creativity as to how people do it. Because there's so much UGC on there, you obviously have the interstitial sections where the content creators are leveraging advertising that way. But I think that's a bit different from how YouTube itself monetizes.
Yeah, there's a lot of different options there and different ways that people can advertise through the platform. Yeah. But yeah, it's got such a vast, vast content. It's really, really uniquely placed within the TV ecosystem. I love what you said before, Christoph, about the Venn diagram. It covers kind of all the different sides of it there. Yeah, really interesting.
There's another component to it too, in that the video patterns themselves are embeddable on the web. So you might not even be on a Google property, but because a brand or another web property is just embedding a YouTube video, that's another insertion point beyond search. And that is a high intent audience, because if they're watching that embedded video on a site specific to that content, you're a little more dialed in that way, right? So you get to benefit from other social platforms also leading to it, right? Like how many LinkedIn posts will drive to a YouTube page, et cetera, et cetera. So that's also something to consider.
Yeah, that's a great point as well. Well, I think that's a great note to finish on. Thanks so much, Christoph, for joining us. Those were some great insights.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. This was a great discussion.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back sometime. And thanks, Matt, as always.
Thanks, Amy. Been a pleasure as ever. And yeah, thanks, Christoph. It's been a really good, really good conversation.
And thanks to all our listeners. That was today's Mad Tech Podcast.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by ExchangeWire.